Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 9, Text 32. Yadyayam kriyate bhakshyas. Oh. Just now coming. Right? Or not? Okay. Yadyayam kriyate bhakshyas. Tarhimam karapurvataha. Tarhimam karapurvataha. Na jivishye vinayena. Na jivishye vinayena. Shanam cha mrittakam yataha. Shanam cha mrittakam yataha. Yadyayam kriyate bhakshyas. Tarhimam karapurvataha. Na jivishye vinayena. Shanam na mrittakam yataha. Okay, I guess. Others? Ayam kriyate bhakshyas. Yadi, if I am this Brahmana, Kriyate is accepted, Bhakshya as edible, Tarhi, then, Mam, me, Kada, eat, Purvataha, before that, Na, not, Jivishye, I shall live, Vina, without, Yena, whom, my husband, Shanam cha, even for a moment, Mritakam, a dead body, Yataha, like. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. This is the wife of the Brahmin speaking. Without my husband, I cannot live for a moment. If you want to eat my husband, it would be better to eat me first. For without my husband, I am as good as a dead body. Purport. In the Vedic culture, there is a system known as sati, or sahamarana, in which a woman dies with her husband. According to this system, if the husband dies, the wife will voluntarily die by falling in the blazing funeral pyre of her husband. Here, in this verse, the feelings inherent in this culture are expressed by the wife of the Brahmana. A woman without a husband is like a dead body. Therefore, according to Vedic culture, a girl must be married. This is the responsibility of her father. A girl may be given in charity, and a husband may have more than one wife, but a girl must be married. This is Vedic culture. A woman is supposed to be always dependent. In her childhood, she is dependent on her father. In her youth, on her husband, and in old age, on her elderly sons. According to Manusamhita, she is never independent. Independence for a woman means miserable life. In this age, so many girls are unmarried and falsely imagining themselves free, but their life is miserable. Here is an instance in which a woman felt that without her husband, she was nothing but a dead body. So we could have picture one up there now, whenever you're ready. So this translation, in the translation, the wife of the Brahmin is saying that she's expressing to this... At least she thinks she's speaking to a king, but she doesn't realize he's totally in the psychology of the Rakshasa at this point. But she's saying, better eat me first, for without my husband I'm as good as a dead body. And in the purport, Prabhupada's talking about sati, right, or the sahamarana. So, I mean, what's the connection? One might ask, what's the connection? Of course, she does perform the sati, right, or the sahamarana act, very soon, in another four verses, we'll hear about how she does that. But at least at this point, she's not doing it. So why is Prabhupada talking about sati, right, or sahamarana in relation to this translation? Well, Prabhupada himself answers that question in the purport. He says, here in this verse, the feelings inherent in this culture are expressed by the wife of a Brahmin. In other words, she's expressing. She's already in the spirit. The spirit behind the sati rite or the sahamarana is that I'd rather be dead than live without my husband. You see? That's how she's feeling. And she's expressing that, unfortunately, inappropriately, or to this king who is transformed into a rakshasa. But here's a picture of Lord Shiva's wife, if I remember correctly, and she's performing the sati right here. Not exactly, because she's self-emulated, but that's the closest thing we could come up with. But the idea is that this, at least in those days, this was actually practical. It was a practical thing for two reasons. One, as is mentioned in a purport that's coming up, in the translation that's coming up, it says here, referring to the wife of the Brahmin. She set fire to her husband's bones, fell into the fire herself, and went with him to the same destination. See, so according to the Bhagavatam, the woman who performed this sati rite, sahamana, would achieve the same destination as her husband. So in that way, it's something, in a way in which to avoid the separation, which was for them more painful than death. You see? And also, as far as this picture goes, in the same way, she's in that spirit. You know, she didn't, Lord Shiva hadn't passed away. She's not entering into Lord Shiva's funeral pyre, but she's in that spirit. Oh, you're my father, you've insulted my husband. Bearing this body that was, you know, I received from you is, I'd rather give it up than, you know, and bear the shame and the pain of having, you know, the body that was given to me by a father who is insulting my exalted husband, Lord Shiva. Now, she had so much affection, so much regard for her husband that she wanted to give up that body that she got from the father who was insulting her husband. So she's exhibiting, once again, that same spirit. But so getting back to the point, how it's practical. So the woman would achieve the same destination as her husband. And for her, for women who were, you know, at this time who were doing this type of thing, it was actually, believe it or not, less painful. It was less painful for them to enter into the fire of the bones of their husband and burn to death like that than it would be to continue to live without their husband. You see? So that was how they were feeling. And this went on in India. This was like, traditionally something that happened. Of course, it was, within recent times, it was stopped by the British government because, sometimes women were being forced to do that. They didn't, the feeling wasn't there, but it was because it was like a tradition and they were being either physically, psychologically pressured to do it or physically or both or whatever. So anyway, they stopped it. And probably it's, and of course it would be the right thing to do because unless that actual feeling is there, then, you can't expect a woman to do that. So in general here, Prabhupada's talking once again, he's the whole man-woman thing comes up. It's Prabhupada's talking about how a girl has to be married. He says it twice in the purport. A woman with like a husband, without a husband is like a dead body. Therefore, according to Vedic culture, a girl must be married. And then a couple sentences later says, a husband may have more than one wife, but a girl must be married. This is Vedic culture. So it's very important. Obviously, this is like something that comes up repeatedly throughout the Bhagavatam, and it's a very big, important issue. The relationship between the sexes like that. And one thought that came to my mind that on this particular issue here was just like, in regular life, if you want to drive a car, you have to have a license. Okay? I remember when I was a kid in New York State, you could get a learner's permit when you were 15 years old. And I did. I had to go, I had to pass a test, a written exam, and I had a learner's permit when I was 15 years old. And then I went to driver's education for a whole year. And at 16 years old, I was driving. I had a license. And even when I was 15 years old, I was able to drive with an adult who had a license in the car. But I had to go. I had to pass this exam. Still, to this day, they have these exams. And I had to go to this driver's education for the whole year. And then finally, when I took my driving test, you have to go and you have to demonstrate practically that you know how to drive. You know, you have to, on the theoretical test, you have to, demonstrate that you understand what's going on. You know, when to give way, when you have right of way, what to do when you hear the sirens, so many different things, right? What are you doing if there's a single yellow, a single white, a double, all those different things, okay? You have to show that you know what to do and what's in different situations. And then you have to go and demonstrate it when you take the driver's test. And they can be very strict. And so this is an analogy. So my point is this, that for a simple thing like driving a car, here in America and all over the world, they have... you have to get a license, and you have to demonstrate that you know what's involved, theoretically and practically. But at least in this day and age, here in America and probably every other country around the world, two people want to get married. To get a marriage license, all you got to do is just come up with whatever it is these days, $50, and just show up at the town hall and say, hey, we want a marriage license. That's it. You see? It doesn't make any sense if you stop and think about it. What's the reason why they want people to have a driver's license? Because when you're behind the wheel there, you're operating something, you could kill other people. You know, you could, what's to speak of yourself, you could kill innocent people, you know, somebody's husband, somebody's wife, somebody's children, somebody's friends, and you could do a lot of damage and mess up a lot of other people's lives. So therefore, they're not going to let you. You have, you know, just any old buddy get behind the wheel. You have to show that you're responsible. So in the same way, when people get married, they can produce children, right? And you know, if those children are not born properly, of course, even if they wouldn't, you know, our philosophy says that, you know, when you produce children, if you're not in the right consciousness, you're going to get Varna Samskara. But, okay, put that aside. You know, that's our own in-house thing. But even the karmas will acknowledge that if children are born and they're not taken care of, you know, the parents aren't ready to have them, and they're not brought up, trained properly and brought up properly, that they generally will not turn out very well. You see? So, but yet, all throughout the world, people can just show up. And with $50, or the, you know, or these days, you don't even have to show up. It's not, a lot of people will just get together and not get married. So my point is that shouldn't be allowed. That shouldn't be allowed. You know, just this, it's such a serious issue. It's such an important thing. So there should be a lot of training and education. And a good parallel, a good analogy is this thing with the driver's license. Just to get a driver's license, you got to, you know, take the written test, and then you got to take the practical test. So in the same way, before in this society, and before they allow people to associate, men and women to associate, there should be some sort of system, you know, that so they can demonstrate that they're qualified. I mean, as far as the nation, the secular world at large goes, it could be done through the schools. You know, it could be like a mandatory thing in school that you have to take courses, so that you know, where they teach you what it's all about. And then before you're allowed to, be with associate or be with somebody, you have to demonstrate your ability to take care of a family. You know, you have to. I have a job. I have an income. I can provide a place to live. Like that, it could be regulated by the government like that initially, and then eventually, when things get back to normal, then initially it was. I mean, in Vedic culture, it was the responsibility of the parents. They took care of that, but you know. Now, of course, that couldn't happen, but it could be done by the government. And certainly, within ISKCON, we definitely should have something. You know, I mean, they might or might not do it. It would be good if the whole world did it, but certainly within ISKCON, we should have something. Within ISKCON, we should be more successful than the world at large at having good relationships between husband and wife. We should not have the same divorce rate as the outside world. We should be it should be really, really significantly less. And that could, something that could help that would be what I'm suggesting, training and education. Training and education so that everybody who's going to be entering into that situation, or even not entering into that situation, knows exactly what it's all about. What are the responsibilities? What are the duties of a male body entering into the Grihastha ashram? What are the duties? What are the responsibilities? What are the rights of a female body? Anything like that. And then everybody, you know, then you could, if you don't have the knowledge, how are you going to act in the right way? You have to, at least initially, you have to start over. You have to know what's the right thing and what's the wrong thing. So that's, you know, of course we get the ideas here sometimes in the Bhagavatam class and by reading Prabhupada's books, but it's such a serious thing that it shouldn't be even left up to just thinking, well, yeah, you know, they hear it in Bhagavatam class or it's in Prabhupada's books. No, it should be tested, just like they do it. They don't just leave it up to... They don't just suggest to people, well, it would be a good idea if you read the road code and maybe, you know, go for pre-practice drives with somebody who knows how to drive. And then, no, they make sure. You got to go there and pass exams. So something like that would probably be a good idea. So we could put that second picture up there now if you want to. Now, this is Chanaka Pandit said, this is an interesting picture. And it's just put us in, the spirit of what I was talking about a little bit. You know, Chanaka Pandit said you can take gold from a filthy place or knowledge from a fool. So this isn't, these aren't devotees we're looking at, but it's an interesting story, and I'm going to tell the story in a second, and I think we could learn something from it. This is a picture of a man in Australia and a woman. They're Australians. And what happened here was, if you look at the lower right-hand corner, that was the girl. She was a famous model in Australia, and she was running in a marathon. And in Australia, it's very dry, you know, place, and so they have bushfires, like they just kind of happen. So she was running in this marathon, and there was a bushfire, a grass fire, and she couldn't escape. And 65% of her body received third-degree burns. And then she was in the hospital for 5 months. And when she went into the hospital, you know, they were boyfriend-girlfriend at that point. She was in the hospital for 5 months. And he quit his job to take care of her. And then when she was being released from the hospital, you know, because of what she looked like, I mean, some of the people in the hospital approached him and said, "So what's going to happen now? Are you going to move on with your life?" And, you know, he said, "No way." He said, "We're married. We're getting..." Either he had already married her, or he said, "We're getting married." He said, "This is the, you know, the I married her soul. I married her character. And this is, you know, the only woman in my life who will ever fulfill my, you know, dreams like that." So notice he did the right thing. And, you know, people all over the world, when I heard about this, they were kind of like pretty impressed. It was pretty impressive. So that's kind of, you know, an interesting thing. We could learn something from that. You know, in India they have that expression, you don't marry the one you love, but you love the one you marry. Of course, you can marry somebody you love, but the more important thing is love the one you marry. You know, it's not about if it feels good, do it. And if it doesn't feel good anymore, don't do it. It's about if you know it's right, do it. You see, so he knew what was right, and he did it. And it was very good, you know. So, you know, that's kind of, everybody can get the idea from that and apply it. So that was that. Now, in general, talking about what's the bigger lesson of what's happening here in this part of the Bhagavatam. This is an interesting section here, as are many sections of the Bhagavatam. And, you know, what's happening here is, like, here's this, all of a sudden, you know, we're hearing about the dynasty of Amsumam, okay? And all of a sudden we're hearing about this king, what was his name, Sodasa. And we're hearing about how he's goes out to the forest, and in the forest he encounters some rakshasas, and one of them he kills. And to the best of my knowledge, for a Vedic king to kill a rakshasa, that's, you know, it's not a sinful thing. That's a good thing. You're supposed to kill rakshasas. They're man eaters, you know. So he killed one of them, the rakshasas, and then he was kind. He decided to be kind. Not a lot of details given, but, you know, we have to try to read between the lines here. And he spared his brother. So his brother, rather than be grateful, wanted to get revenge. So he devised a plot, a scheme, by which he could get revenge. He became the cook in the king's palace. And in the appropriate time, when the king's spiritual master was visiting, Vasishtha Muni, he made sure to serve him human flesh. So, and it's described how Vasishtha Muni, due to his mystic powers, he could understand that that was what was going on, and he immediately became outraged, and he cursed the king to become a rakshasa for 12 years. And then Vasishtha Muni realized he made a mistake, and he performed penance for 12 years to free him, you know, purify himself, but didn't do anything for the king. So anyway, so this king, basically he became a rakshasa. He still looked like his old self, but he had the psychology of a rakshasa and the activities of a rakshasa. So, and of course, you know, on another occasion, he goes out and he sees this Brahmin and his wife getting ready to perform Garbhanam Samskar, and he grabs the Brahmin and he's about to eat him, and that brings us up to the thing today. So, what's going on here? I mean, you know, what are we supposed to, why is this, what are we supposed to learn from this? Well, I'd like to make the point here that I think there is something we're supposed to learn from this. And Well, yeah, I'll say what it is. I think what it is is that you have to be fully surrendered to Krishna. You know, it's not like, you know, you could be pious, as this king was, seemed like a pious. I mean, you don't become a king by being impious. I mean, it's not, you don't, generally somebody doesn't become a king as a result of their past sinful activities. You got to be a pious personality to be a king. So he was a pious person. You know, he demonstrated that by killing one Rakshasa and, you know, he was sparing the other. But, and the Brahmin, you know, he was a, his wife was saying, as far as his wife is concerned, he was a qualified Brahmin. She was obviously pretty qualified because she was able to curse him, you know, and she was also able to, you know, had the willing determination to enter into the funeral pyre. So, you know, these are pious people. But yet we could see that these horrible things are happening to them. The king is, he seems like he's innocent. I mean, you know, he got innocently cursed. It was unfair. It seemed like, from superficially, it seems like, oh, this is so unfair. This nice king who spared this one, he killed one Rakshasa, he spared the other, and he gets cursed, you know, by his spiritual master to become a Rakshasa. And you know, well, how is this happening? And there's other details I could throw in there, but just for the sake of time, I'm watching the clock there, I'm going to skip them. But it's really kind of like, wow, well, why does that happen? It seems so unfair. And the Brahmin and his wife, that seems so unfair. Well, it does seem unfair, but here's the way to understand it, that it's karma. It's karma, you know? It's a background story. That's our philosophy. There's a back, because it doesn't mention in any place that these three personalities were pure devotees. They were pious, but there's no mention that they were pure devotees, or devotees even. So they were receiving their karma, right? And that's how it works in this material world. You know, you could be very, very nice, but that's not protection. That's not going to save you from having some horrible, horrible thing happen to you. You see? I mean, even the nicest people, they're performing sinful activities. Prabhupada, in one lecture, I can't remember the full Sanskrit, but he refers to it as panchasuno. There's five sinful activities that everybody performs. Even, you know, if you're somebody who's very pious and virtuous, which is when you walk, you kill little insects. When you light a fire, you kill insects. When you grind spices in a mortar and pestle, you kill them. When you breathe, and there's one more. Drinking water. So, you know, and Prabhupada said, you get reaction for that. You see? So that's why you can't, if somebody's thinking, you know what, I know you're supposed to, ideally supposed to surrender to Krishna fully, and that's the best thing to do, and it's the most auspicious thing to do, but I'm not ready to do that, but I think I'll just be really pious. So therefore, I mean, I know it's not, I won't surrender to Krishna, I'll be really pious, and therefore good things will happen to me. I know I'll stay here in the material world, but at least good things will happen to me. Uh-uh. No. Wrong. Mistake. You know? You can't count on that. You can't count on that. You know? It might not work out like that. And here's examples of that. You know, we don't know why these things are happening to these people, but they happen. But Krishna explains it, actually. It's not a secret. Krishna explains in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. He says, Yagnar tat kamanonyatra loko yam karma bandana tadartam karma kuntaya mukta sangha samachara. And in his purport, the translation is, work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed, otherwise work causes bondage in this material world. Therefore, O son of Kunti, perform your prescribed duties for his satisfaction, and in that way you will always remain free from bondage. And Prabhupada in the purport, he says, therefore one has to work for the satisfaction of Vishnu. Any other work done in this material world will be the cause of bondage for both good and evil work have their reactions. That's it. See, if you're not working for the satisfaction of Vishnu, if you're not engaged trying to surrender to Krishna, engaged in devotional service, following the instructions of the spiritual master, you're, you know, engaging in activities that you're going to get a material reaction for. Minimally, you'll have to take birth again, you know, to get those reactions, and they could be reactions you don't want. So it's not a good program. It's not a good program to think that, you know, you could be here in the material world, not fully surrender to Krishna, and still be okay. And now you could say, well, wait a second, but what you're saying, where does it say that? I mean, you know, where isn't saying that in the pages here? Well, my point on that would be, my response to that would be this, that the teachings of the Bhagavatam are progressive, and it's implied. Just like when you when you're in school. Like yesterday, I was on a campus and some girl was walking around with a book on differential equations. Okay, so if I would open that book, you know, I'd be seeing instructions about differential equations. It's not that every time that textbook introduced a new concept about differential equations, it would be reteaching me how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. It doesn't work like that. It's understood. It's understood. You got to know that, buddy. You're in calculus here. We're expecting that you understand how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. We're not going to explain it to you every time you... But it's there, you see? So in the same way, Bhagavatam just... this is not Dick and Jane. You know, when you're reading the Bhagavatam, you're not reading about Dick and Jane. I don't know if you had... We had Dick and Jane in readers when we were kids in school, you know? It's not like that. This is advanced level stuff. But this is there, and this is what I think this is the point we're supposed to get from this. It's just another reminder that don't think you could be happy here in the material world. Because, look, things do go wrong. Things can go wrong, and things do go wrong. And the classic example of that, I mean, what to speak of these three nice people here, the classic example of that is given in the Krishna book is King Mrga. Just to refresh everybody's memory, his story, Krishna was playing with some friends in the, you know, and they spotted this big lizard in a well. And they went, the cowherd boys went to try to get this lizard out, and they couldn't get him out. So they went and got Krishna. Maybe it was his sons. Actually, it was Krishna's sons. It was his family members, because he preaches to him afterwards. So they couldn't get him out. So they went and got Krishna, and Krishna just, you know, stuck his hand in there and easily got him out. And immediately was transformed into his original form, a king, King Mrga. And so Krishna asked him to please explain your story here. How do we understand this? And so the king said, "Well, I know, you know everything. You're the Supreme Personality of Godhead." He got enlightened to some extent as well, as just from Krishna touching him. But he said, "But since you're asking me, I'll tell you." He said, "My name is King Mrga. I'm the son of Maharaj Ikshvaku. And if you know anything about charitably disposed people, then you will know my name, because I'm so charitable. I've given away cows in charity." That was, you know, when you wanted to give charity back in those days, that was the recommended thing to do, to give nice cows in charity to Brahmins. So it's stated that he gave more cows in charity to Brahmins than there are stars in the sky or grains of sand on the beach. This guy was charitable. But still, look what happened. Everybody knows the story. He gave a cow to one Brahmin, and that cow wandered back into his herd, and then he didn't know. He gave that same cow to another Brahmin, and then the Brahmin he originally gave it to detected that cow in the other Brahmin's herd, and he complained, and he wanted that cow back, and it was a whole big to-do, and he got cursed for that. It wasn't even his fault, you see? But so there's a perfect classic example of it, how, you know, he was a very super pious guy, but he wasn't a pure devotee of Krishna. He wasn't fully surrendered to Krishna, so therefore he wasn't fully protected from the reactions. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Sarvadhamam parichaja mame kam saranam vraja aham tvam sarvapapabhyo moksha yasyami masacha." Abandon all varieties of religion. The word is dharma, you know, dharma, all the different things. When we think of, you know, when we hear that, we think abandon, what does that mean? Abandon the Christian religion, abandon the Muslim religion. It's not exactly that. Sarvadhamam, all the things you might do to try to get elevated materially, the different dharmas. That's what, you know, in the Vedic sense, that's, I think, what it's referring to. So all the different dharmas, the things you might do to elevate yourself to heavenly planets or whatever, you know, give them up, Krishna's saying. Sarva dharmam pratishya. Abandon all varieties of activities you might perform to elevate yourself materially and surrender to me. And Krishna says, if you do that, I will protect you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. Which means if you do that, you'll be protected from the reaction to past sinful activities you perform. And, you know, Krishna will give you intelligence not to perform sinful activities at present. But if you don't do it, you're not. See, so it's kind of like you don't get your cake and eat it too. You got to do like that in order to be protected from reactions to all sinful activities. So anyway, that's the lesson from this part of the Bhagavatam. So, we have to do that. We have to not dilly-dally around. Prabhupada used to quote his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, just says, "This material world is no place for a gentleman." He used to compare it to a latrine or a stool house. Just do your business and get out. Don't dilly-dally. You know, don't have that plan of thinking that, you know, surrender to Krishna. I like that. It's a nice idea later. There might not be a later. There might not be a later. Okay? Just, I can't remember what prompted me to do it, but over the last couple of weeks ago, I made this list. Somebody passed away. It was Brahmananda. I think I did it after Brahmananda passed away. Maybe it was after just Surabhi. But I made this list of all the devotees that I knew who are no longer with us. And I got 100 people, and I probably haven't. And these are just ones I knew. I didn't put down people whose name I heard, but these are people I actually personally had a relationship with. You know, I went out and sankirtan with them. They were my roommate, or somebody I knew well, a temple president or my GBC or something. And I got 100, and that's just devotees, right? So we're thinking we're an illusion if we're thinking that I'm going to live here for a nice long time. We're not all going to be Amala Bhaktas, living to a ripe old age in good health. And it would be nice. I hope everybody does to have that good fortune. But, really, the nature of this world is that at any moment, something could happen and you're gone. You get hit, killed in a car crash, or you just find out you got terminal this or that, and so we really can't count on that. So there's a very, and I think I'll conclude on this point, a very beautiful and relevant verse that appears in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam that gives us a great instruction. And we should really kind of meditate on this because it's right on the money. It goes, Labha sudurlabham idam bahusambhavanti manusham arthadam anicham apiya dira tornam yateta napatet anumritya yavan Nishreyasaya Vishaya Kalu Sarvatasyat. This is an Avadhuta Brahmin instructing King Yadu, and he says, after many, many births and deaths, one achieves the rare human form of life, which, although temporary, affords one the opportunity to attain the highest perfection. Thus, a sober human being should quickly endeavor for the ultimate perfection of life, as long as his body, which is always subject to death, has not fallen down and died. So basically what he's saying is, while you're still alive, go for it. After all, sense gratification is available even in the most abominable species of life, whereas Krishna consciousness is only possible for a human being. So anyway, that's kind of no purport required. That verse speaks for itself. It's very clear. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Sorry, I went a few minutes over time. The spotlight there. Is that what this is for, right?
Is it called Saha Marana? Saha Marana. If that's performed today, would that still be effective?
Well, it's illegal as far as the outside world goes, but I don't know. I mean, it's a Vedic ritual. If you could avoid, I would say, yeah, I would say it would be effective in the sense that if a woman really felt like that and did it in that consciousness that it's more painful for me to live without my husband, so I'll just enter into his funeral fire like that, and she did it in that in the proper consciousness that, I mean, the statement is that she achieves the same destination as her husband. So, because as I said, it's not something that you'd want to do because probably you'd get the whole this kind of trouble by doing it, but I think it could work. I mean, it doesn't. There are statements, there's certain things that aren't supposed to be, like there's that one statement about this five sacrifices that aren't supposed to be formed in Kali Yuga. There might be some injunction like that as far as that goes for the Kali Yuga. I'm not sure. But in principle, I would think, yeah, it could work, but not advised. Yeah, Architabu.
Hi, Rabbi. Well, thank you for a nice presentation. This apparently was one of those hot potato verses So as a person who scheduled classes, I just want to ask the speakers, if you're scheduled for a class, don't look ahead and say, here's a verse that I don't want to speak on. That's not allowed. Whatever verse Krishna aligns for you, because you reserve the day, you know, like I want to speak two Thursdays from now. And then you see, oh, this verse is coming up and I don't want to speak. I don't want that. Whatever verse Krishna aligns for you, speak on that. Because every verse in the Bhagavatam is important. So the hot potato here seemed to be the statement about women don't have independence. But this applies to everybody. Nobody's independent in the material world. That's the whole point. It's not that only women don't have independence. Nobody's independent. We're all dependent. And being dependent doesn't mean you don't have any personality or opinion. This is the modern outlook that if I'm not independent, then I don't have any voice. Or look at the classic case of the Pandavas. Kunti, as the mother, was dependent on her five boys. But they listened to everything she said, to the point where when Arjuna came home with Draupadi, she said, whatever you brought, share with your brothers. And therefore, she had to marry all five of them. So even though she was in the dependent role, she was actually controlling them. Whatever she said to her sons, they did. So we shouldn't take this foolish modern outlook that, oh, independence, I have to be independent. What is this about women? And no, we're talking about ideal society here. This is ideal society with ideal instructions. Now, as time goes by and the people are not ideal, they misuse those instructions. They misuse those rituals and rites and like that. But that doesn't make them wrong. That's the whole point that we have to project to the public. That the Vedic injunctions, the Vedic rituals, the Vedic lifestyle is perfect. This is what God wants. This is what Krishna wants. Mm-hmm. And if it's misused and abused in some way, it doesn't mean that the system should be thrown away. That means that people need to be educated, just like you said. They should be educated before marriage. They should be educated before any ashram, not just marriage, before becoming a brahmachari, before becoming a grihastha, before becoming a vanaprastha, before becoming a sannyasi. Gradually, we are instituting that in ISKCON. Everybody has to be trained. Before you become a guru, you have to go through guru school. Before you become a sannyasi, you have to go to sannyasi school.
Yeah, and Prabhupada wanted that. And I'll give an example. Prabhupada, in more than one letter, asked for Bhakti Shastri and Bhakti, you know, these courses. And you could say, he didn't, like, make it, he didn't force it. Prabhupada's mood was this, that ideally, he would like to see that happen, that this formal education would be there. But he didn't want that to turn people away from being devotees. You know, simultaneously, Prabhupada's mood was, okay, look, if you can't get that together, just do whatever you can do. But ideally, if you can, you know, get to do the formal training, get the formal education, and get a degree, you know, Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav, Bhakti Sarvabhauma, wonderful. And if you can't, don't get discouraged. Just keep chanting Hare Krishna, be a devotee. So in the same way, you know, it's good to have these formal training things for everybody. A guru should have training. You know, GBC should have to have training. A sannyasi, every situation, it's good to have training and education, some formal type of thing, so that you, when you get to that thing, you know what you're doing. And you don't mess up your life and other people's lives by not knowing what you're doing. So is that sort of along the same note? Yes, thank you. Okay. Well, let's take one of the women, Mother Nagapatni, some of the women.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the nice class. Srila Prabhupada says in the first canto, in the purport, that this entering of a chaste lady into the fire of her dead husband is called the sati rite, and the action is considered to be most perfect for a woman. In a later age, the sati rite became an obnoxious criminal affair because the ceremony was forced upon even an unwilling woman. It's no longer acceptable.
Read that last sentence again.
In a later age, this sati rite became an obnoxious criminal affair because the ceremony was forced upon even an unwilling woman.
Right. But his question was, like, I think, Vedically, does it still have, if somebody were to do that, and, you know, in an isolated place with no, you know, the outside society not knowing about it, does it have the potency?
Today, it's become a big issue in India where people are killing their daughter-in-laws and calling it sati rite, using it as an excuse for accumulating more money.
Yeah.
Getting rid of people they don't want. Yeah. It's become a degraded
affair. Better not do it. leave that philosophical question unanswered. Mother Kundalini.
Sometimes I study mental health, and they have statistics about suicide in America, and it used to be more among teenagers or people who are very sick. But they're finding a new rise in suicide among men in their 40s and 50s whose wives have divorced them after they took care of them their whole lives and raised the kids together. And then the wife leaves them, and then he's in shock. So that's the new divorce. That's the new suicide statistic is male divorcees.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and I had a question. The king, yesterday and today, we heard that the king was innocent and he was unduly punished. It's true, he's harshly punished. But on the other hand, was he completely innocent? Because if you're running a kitchen, and you have a cook, and he serves meat to people, there, you know, that's you should be aware of that. You should be aware that you have a cook who has a mean mentality, you know, who's doing something that is against, you know, and also kings would go out and hunt and kill animals, so they sometimes had meat in their kitchens, you know. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it just slipped by him. I'm sure he didn't do it on purpose.
No, yeah. Not to his guru, but I'm just wondering, you know, Kshatriyas, there's some allowance for them to eat meat, and I don't know.
Well, you know, he's not completely innocent, maybe even in that regard, you know, but certainly, as I said, there's a background story, and probably it's relates to something he did in some previous life or something like that. He's getting a reaction for that.
Yeah, I think that's why Prabhupada had such a very high standard for our deities in what we offer to them. So that we wouldn't have, there'd be a kitchen in every ISKCON temple that was completely pure, 100% pure vegetarian with no, nothing, you know, mixed in there.
Okay, Prabhu, yeah, some very good comment.
Well, you know, what we reading Bhagavatam is talking about, you know. Process of understanding where we are not this body, we are the soul. And we also know in Vedic science that at the time Satyuga and all the ages are passing, the human mentality is getting more away from the soul versus to the body. Okay, then this age, because majority of people are living with that I'm this body, so that's why it's hard to understand certain things, you know, in the Vedic scriptures. And if you look at from that, so what, as for us, you know, we have to look at perspectively, you know, what we are reading is this is ideal time when people, majority of people were thinking they are not this body. And Prabhupada is, the whole Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita is based on that concept, you know, and the whole process is to understand that. And so to me, this whole, like, you know, modern age, you know, like, okay, even I am this body, I should know even if what are my bad qualities are. So I think, so they, now this concept that both bodies are the equal, you know, the man body and the women body are the equal. And that's where the people try to get into this argument, you know, that, yeah, we should be treated equally, but there are limitations in the men's body and there are limitations in the women's body. That's why Prabhupada think that all the women should be married. It was a Vedic thing, you know, it was thinking that there are limitations in this body, so we just have to accept it. And that comes because once we think that we are not this body, we are the soul. Because of this body, I have some limitations. And so I think that's where this whole argument about equality and, you know, and all those things comes up.
Okay, so that was a comment. Thank you. Anybody else, anything? Amal Bhakta, and then that'll be it. No? Later. Do it afterwards. Oh, okay. Still got it.
First of all, my apologies for keeping you another 4 or 5 minutes from prasadam. My hostile nature. But I wanted to just make one point you had mentioned, and I've heard many devotees mentioned this, that in the story of King Riga that you brought out very nicely, that he was not culpable, he was not blameworthy, and therefore he had to suffer some heavy consequence, which was to become a gigantic lizard, you know, that was in the well. But actually he is culpable, he was blameworthy, because that possibility always existed that a cow could wander back into your herd. And there was a possibility, if that possibility exists, he took no precaution and made no prevention so that if it did wander back, he would know that. Now, how could that have been done? Well, all he had to do is paint the hoof with a certain mark which indicated that it was given in charity. So if it had wandered back into his herd, he would have seen that particular marking that it was given in charity. Therefore, he cannot give it away to anybody. He must just keep it until the person from whose herd it wandered out of, he will come and look for it, and he can then give it back to this person that he gave it to. Okay. That way it would be completely preventative and what we call proactive, as opposed to merely, well, that could never happen, and now this happened. So therefore, in everything that we do in life, we have to always try our best to think a little ahead of what possibilities exist, what potentialities exist. If we don't do that, then when the problem occurs or the difficulty occurs, it was because, not always, but it can be the result of our not really thinking something through as fully as we possibly could. And that's the point is there. That possibility existed, but he took no precaution, and consequently he got the consequence from that.
Thank you. Interesting point. Okay, thank you very much. Gantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.